coming up on today's Compassion Radio.
It should have been more of a triage stop. You show up on the Greek islands, you declare your intent to apply for asylum. You know, you have your interviews, you turn yourself in, and then, you know, 3, 4, 5 months, theory, you would get your answer. That was not what was happening. For 3 or 4 months, no one's going to care. And they really didn't. When it became 6 months, 9 months, a year, 2 years, it became a long-term home.
What does the Christian do when the world is on fire? Well, you grab a fire hose and send up some urgent prayers. What? Were you thinking of something else? Hello, friends. Bram Floria here with news from the places where spiritual first responders are literally doing the impossible. Today's guest is Exhibit A. There's a lot of interview today and only 26 minutes to fit it all in, so we'll get right to it. On Compassion Radio today, we're visiting with a brand that we met on the very front lines of missions work and relief work a couple of years ago in the country of Greece. Jeremy Holloman, welcome back to Compassion Radio.
Thank you.
Now, you had a thankless job last time I met you. You were, at the time, trying to figure out how to deal with the intractable problem of refugees being swept up in the Aegean Sea, being dumped on the island of Lesbos. The Moria camp at that time was about 45,000 people, which was about 40,000 over capacity, and you were running this camp on behalf of our good friends at Conscience International and a number of other agencies that had made you the chief relief worker there. So tell me just a little bit about that time that you spent on the island of Lesbos back in 2017 and before.
Yeah, I think we got there in 2016. My first trip to the island was in 2015. And then my family came with me there at Easter in 2016, and we stayed until August of 2018. It was chaotic.
Yeah.
A lot of different organizations working. We had a lot of volunteers coming to Euro Relief, which was the group that I'd been seconded to from Conscience International. So they are still active in the camp, or were until it burned down. I don't believe there'll be any role for any nonprofit organization in the new setup.
Okay, during the time that you were there in Moria, what was your objective? You're a private relief agency in Euro Relief, working with Conscience International and a number of other agencies. So that time was meant to show the power and the efficiency of private agencies that had real passion and compassion for those who were swept up in all these world events and dumped them on the shores of Greece. Were you more effective at being a relief agency than the government could have been at that time?
I still have friends in the government over there, but yeah, I think we were, for some reasons that we weren't bureaucratic. We were small enough to make immediate changes. You know, we didn't have multiple layers of government oversight. We were just better able to adapt. I mean, we weren't bound to the government procedures for acquisition and hiring and, you know, all that stuff.
Now, when I was with you for the few days we had there, you were busily reorientating the entire camp to accommodate new immigrants that were showing up from Central Africa. And there were some political problems with some of the young men taking over spaces that needed to be allocated for mothers and small children. The kind of population would flux all the time throughout. And we were running people up and down the hills, moving them from one wing to another. It was an organized chaos, as far as I could tell. You had a plan, but it took a lot of execution.
Yeah, our volunteers did great. And the first time I visited Moria, there was a sign up for the front that said, find a place to sleep. I thought, surely we can do a little better than that. If we knew where they were sleeping, that also made it easier to find them when we needed them for interviews or when it was time. A lot of times the UN would get transfers approved to the mainland right before they needed to move out, because the UN only facilitated it. The Greek government actually approved the transfer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would work with the UN to try to find the people. So if we knew where they were at, it made it a lot easier to get them. And it made it more equitable in housing, so we didn't have so many people sleeping rough. But as you saw the spot, we were overcrowded.
Yeah, you were definitely overcrowded in that place. Give me a rundown of the kind of functions you would have to go through with each refugee that came through. You didn't just take them in and feed them and house them. Your plan was to move them on to somebody who could deal with their long-term issues much more effectively, or give them at least an interim home. And the Moria camp, of course, was not a real home.
No, it should have been more of a triage stop. You show up on the Greek islands, you declare your intent to apply for asylum. You know, you have your interviews, you turn yourself in, and then, you know, 3, 4, 5 months, theory, you would get your answer. That was not what was happening. So we really were just supposed to be a place where you get here, we can get you some dry clothes, we can get you medical care, we can get you stabilized, you'll be able to get in touch with your relatives back wherever it was, that kind of stuff. Get your feet under you, And then, yeah, it was going to be a crowded existence, but for 3 or 4 months, no one's going to care. And they really didn't. When it became 6 months, 9 months, a year, 2 years. So it became a long-term home, even though it was only supposed to be temporary for a lot of people.
This was a barracks for the Greek military, and then it got converted into this ad hoc camp.
Well, then it became like a police prison kind of place, and that was emptied, and then they gave it over to the camp to process. And originally, before the EU-Turkey deals, people were just coming to the island. They registered at Moria, and then they were given basically a get-out-of-jail-free card, and they could travel into other areas of Europe because they had suspended the Dublin Agreement. So they were only on the island as long as it took them to register and get a ferry ticket. And then they were gone. So they were there 1, 2, 3 nights, you know, a week max. And then that changed dramatically after the EU-Turkey deal, and it became a long-term home.
So what was your biggest frustration being a camp director before you left in 2018?
I had lots of frustration. You know, there were days where beating my head against a brick wall seemed like a better idea than going to work. You know, one was just lack of resources. You've got all these people coming in, and I'm putting them in three-season tents that were scrounging 20 or 25 euros and buying, you know, a tent. And, you know, if I'm lucky, I've got a pallet to go under it, so they're off the ground. Because most of that housing space in the prefab modular homes or in the dorm definitely was a lack of resources and a lack of space, perceived to be just a general overall lack of caring from not the Greek management on the island, but in Athens and, you know, the EU handlers.
The folks that are removed from the actual situation, they don't know the people. Now, what was your greatest joy or meaningful reward for having done this?
Good question. It was great to see a lot of volunteers come together under one banner from disparate organizations that were partnering with EuroLeaf. And generally, these are folks in the, you know, at least from the Christian end, you don't normally organizations that you would expect to be best friends due to different doctrines, you know, that kind of stuff. But it all worked out. Everybody came together. They did what they could do. We had a lot of first trip out of the country, first passport, threw them into Moria. And, you know, by and large, they did well. And that was pleasant. That was fine. And several of the people who worked for us, one of my assistant managers, they've gone on to other professional. And by professional, I mean, you know, paid staff, NGOs, and a couple of them are country directors now, and a couple more are in the process of working their way through the ranks, and they all got their start there in Moria.
Awesome. And your inspiration for them gives them a lot of hope for what can happen. I suppose if they started their careers under a camp director that was completely malfeasant, it would have spoiled for them any hope for what relief work could be and providing solutions for people who really need it. So I'm glad you're able to provide that kind of inspiration. When I was there, I think people from Sweden and Germany, and there are a whole bunch of Mennonites from the U.S. that were there.
Yep.
And then other
tons of Mennonite folks.
And there was lots of young people from different missions agencies that were doing like a world race kind of stops to help you out along the way.
Right.
I imagine it kind of was a revolving door for you, even with the help, not just the people coming through the camp.
We were constantly training. You understand, there is a degree of professionalism that you must maintain to be successful. 2 week volunteers aren't coming with that. So you've got a day to train them to try to give them that. And then the best thing after that is you have to have that professionalism in your leaders in camp. So that was constantly a struggle with getting people at least to the point where we could get them in Moria and get them somewhat useful. So we had to have strong systems in place.
I noticed that the people either had a naivete and they were planning to change the world in a week. And then those who had been there for a while had kind of what I call a compassionate skepticism. Because they see human nature at its worst and at its best.
And you got a lot of that. You got a lot of people, I'm coming to save the world. I'm coming to save the Muslim world. And that doesn't happen in a week. That's a long, long-term project. It just doesn't happen. And so we had to deal with that a lot. And that's, you know, we tried to manage their expectations coming into it. That was a big part of it.
In a moment, I'd like to ask you about what's happened and transpired on Moria in the past few weeks. But I want to ask you, on your way out, what was your takeaway from your experience leading that camp? What did you feel like the future of relief work and the conflicts and the refugee situations in the Middle East were going to be going forward?
Well, one of the takeaways is that the powers that be in the countries that are not producing refugees have really got to revamp their thought processes and their procedures and their policies on what constitutes a refugee and how to deal with them, because the numbers are just astronomical. A lot of the old systems just aren't going to work, especially now it's a digital age. We're much more mobile than ever before. It's a travel to get out of these places is facilitated by air travel. Not to say that it's a super easy road for them, because it's not. I don't want to generalize. It's one of the big things is that the Western governments, because that's where most of these folks are going to, are trying to get to revamp their rules, their laws, to what is a refugee, how long should someone be a refugee and how we handle that. In Greece, one of my takeaways certainly was that you saw a swarm of refugees hitting the country that was probably just about the least able to handle it in the European Union due to their own corruption. And, you know, they invented democracy, but I like to also say they invented bureaucracy. and then with their own financial crisis, they're already mired down in. It was the perfect storm for a catastrophe.
And it has worn on. I was rather surprised that there were still tens of thousands in the camp over this past year. I got the impression because of the Turkish deal with the EU that most of them have been held back, or that the smugglers have been shut down more than they have been.
No, I think there's some bad blood between Turkey and Greece right now that I think Greece is trying to address to NATO. I don't have first-hand knowledge of that right now, but that's my understanding that that is. The whole time that I was there, we have very few deportations. Turkey has agreed to take them back, and it's a process. And the week that you did have it, usually you might have 10 to 20, sometimes 30, sometimes a little less, and it wasn't an every-week thing. They have the volunteer repatriation program that where people would volunteer to go back to their countries as long as it wasn't considered dangerous for them.
I can't imagine how much the desperation must be continuing in the middle of the COVID pandemic that people are still making the effort to get to Greece and continue this journey.
When what is behind you is far worse than what is ahead of you, that's a no-brainer choice. You know, when I was there in 2018 even, you were hearing people that made 3, 4, 5 attempts to get onto a boat on the Turkish side to get across. You know, when you're in a country where bombs are falling, you know, war is not the worst thing in the world. And even in Turkey, if you hear the way the stories of how some of them are being treated at the hands of the Turkish police and the Turkish government, life in the European Union is theoretically going to be a better place for them.
Now, when people talk about making 4 or 5 attempts to get even as far as Greece, they're not just sitting on the beach 4 or 5 days in a row trying to get a ride. You're talking about people who are interdicted and sent back their countries of origin time after time.
You know, a lot of times in Turkey, the smugglers have you out on the beach and you'll stay in the woods. We had babies who were born in the woods and then come over a few days later while he waited to get enough guys together to go for the coast to be clear and you to try and you get sent back. Sometimes you'd get arrested by the Greeks, by the Turks, and then they would try to push you back to the camps on the southern border, depending on where you're from. Most of them just didn't walk across like they used to and just take the first boat. It was a lot of multiple attempts, which could also involve the families being separated on the Turkish side. Some people make it, some people don't. There were supposed to be 3 boats. The Turkish police show up. They start throwing people in boats and kicking them off the shore. And maybe your wife and son made one boat. You made another. Which boat makes it? We don't know. They go to 2 different landing spots, which might have meant you went to 2 different first camps on Lesbos. So lots of stuff.
And it's still a very treacherous crossing on top of that. The smugglers themselves had tried to be a little more compassionate on people because they were seeing refugees piloting their own boats full of tanks of gas and getting all the way to the Greek side of the channel. They were doing this at night, and because they're not seafarers, they see a lighthouse or something and go straight toward it, like a moth toward a flame.
Right. You go away from that lighthouse.
And then they discovered the hard way that this is the most dangerous place to go.
That is correct.
So they started sending them out in the channel with only half a tank of gas. The engine would conk out somewhere in the middle of the channel.
If the boat makes it to the Greek water, they can apply for asylum. But if someone tries to take that boat back, then they can be arrested. So they would just give someone, here you go, this is how you do it. Turn it on, point that way. Here's the tiller. You know, a lot of people couldn't swim. They had life. It's funny, they were pretty strict about them all having life jackets. You know, I never really saw people that didn't have them. But a lot of times the life jackets were stuffed with cardboard or straw and not any sort of useful flotation device.
So there's a kind of a quasi gray market, if you want to call it that, for this kind of exportation of people. It changes from day to day.
It's money in the movement of people.
Always big money in that. Yep. But what do you see now? Obviously, something's up. In the West here, we're hearing zero news anymore about conflicts happening in Syria or Iraq or in the Kurdistan territories or along the borders of Turkey. So we have the impression then that the wars are all over. ISIS has been defeated. There's nothing else going on. People should be staying put where they are, just starting over.
They're defeated. They may not control like Khalifat anymore, you know, but you still see some things going on in Afghanistan and in Syria. Like, I don't know how, but the government seems to have regained the upper hand and they're pushing to free the last free, I say, you know, from their viewpoint, the last strongholds of the rebel, as they would call it, the Free Syrian Army and those guys. So the conflict isn't over. And it's not just a matter of conflict being over. There's nothing there. There's no economy. A lot of stuff bombed and burned out. There's not a lot of law enforcement. And you still have a lot of bad guys running around. So you're still going to see this refugee exodus, even if the conflict ended tomorrow, at least a couple of years anyway, because now the world has to get together and figure out how to rebuild these countries. because rebuilding is going to be beyond their scope, at least on the short term, medium term.
Absence of bombs does not mean instantly a renewal of all of your infrastructure, water, food, everything else. You're going to be, right, still be starving, sitting on a rubble pile.
When I was in Greece, the term economic refugees was thrown out about, like that made them a lesser refugee. And maybe there is something to that, but it's not just war that you would flee and can make you a refugee. And when you have no place to work, you have no functioning utilities, and you have no way to feed your family, it's just as bad of a situation. Instead of death by bomb, it's long-term death by starvation. So you're going to see people leave from that, and rightfully so. I mean, if you can't survive where you're at, then you're not going to stay. You got a family, or even just yourself. You're going to get out.
Put a layer of all this political tumults in the world this year, and the re-election prospects of our current president, what may or may not happen for our country after the November election, the economy struggling to rebound, all the COVID issues. We become very insular, I think, because of our own worries about our own personal situation, which is
certainly,
which is normal. This is human nature to be focused on the things that are most immediate to you. But that does not mean that the things that are going on in Greece or in the Middle East have no impact anymore on what's happening here, or that we should be unaware of it. That's why we try to, you know, spend a little bit of time on this program to focus on these issues. So that being the case, what do you think happened at the Moria camp here this past week?
Well, we had fires in the camp before, and they were all usually intentionally set. Not always, but usually. And again, I'm just giving you secondhand information, and I'm getting from guys that I used to work with there, friends that I have there. There were no COVID-19 precautions that were being taken inside the camp. They were not provided masks or anything like that. And when you have 12,000 people living in that tight area, it's going to happen sooner or later. So a refugee came in, down with COVID-19. And then that rapidly spread, and they were forcing them to quarantine with their families from the rest of the camp. But then they were forcing the camp to be closed, so you weren't allowed to come and go, at least on the inside of the camp. And rumor has it that the thing that finally kicked it off was not just the camp being closed. Now, they weren't allowed to come in and out. The rumor was, and I don't know if it was true or not, but that the fencing supplies had come in because, you know, the camp had spread out beyond the camp footprint you had seen. Right. We had in the olive groves, I think to the north and to the east of the camp, you know, you get thousands of people living in tents out there. So the government rented it officially, and they were going to, the word is they were going to fence it all in one camp, and you were going to, it's going to become a closed camp again, like it was right after the turkey kill, where you could not come or go as you pleased. You were basically stuck there until you had official reasons for leaving. And so some fires started.
And they could see a prison coming.
Yeah. Well, that's what it was. And fires started. My understanding was three fire engines serviced the area, and some smaller fires had been started elsewhere. This is what the Lesbos Fire Department has said. So they only had one real engine that they could attack the fire with. And then, as typical, when it showed up, refugees were throwing rocks and trying to prevent it from putting out the fires. You know, when you got a crowd like that, living conditions, it doesn't take much to get everybody stirred up. And I have seen that firsthand in multiple fires. They'll get themselves whipped up into a frenzy. The fire department really just comes in and mops up after it's over, because until the refugee pure dies down, there were some after fires that flamed up and burned down some more of the stuff that didn't totally burn down the first time. So the camp's pretty much a bust at this point.
Which means most of their meager belongings are gone as well. And of course, majority of the people that are there are not angry young men. Most of what I saw there were families and vulnerable women and children that were stuffed cheek and jowl with all of these other migrants escaping war, being conscripted by armies or for economic reasons or because they're young and have the strength to go and were sent by their families. This is a total mishmash of humanity there. And I'm sure that most of the women and children are not standing there throwing rocks.
No, my understanding is too that it was primarily an Afghan camp now, 70 to 80% Afghan. Usually when you have a majority, it's usually easier to deal with. You know, when I was there, we had people from 44 countries. And then the Arabs were divided even by country. There might be 10 to 12 different factions. So you had to have leaders for each one. And but the Afghans were always pretty united behind one person. You know, even still with all that, stuff happened. You know, they were rightfully outraged at what's going on. I'm not condoning the fire by any stretch, but I do understand it and what happened. And so now they are sleeping on side of the roads. There was a military firing range around the corner close to the Lidl. I don't know if you remember where the Lidl was when you were there.
I do.
And they put up a bunch of tents, and they say it can hold, you know, 10,000 people. It's going to be 20 people per tent from what I've seen to come anywhere near holding 10,000 people. So some people have already gone in. It is a closed camp. My understanding as of yesterday is none of the NGOs were allowed in. And once you go in, you're not allowed out. The military was providing food once a day. They were covering two meals. So I don't know how you cover that third meal if you can't leave the camp to buy anything. You know, there was a lot of also, my understanding is a lot of, they call them fascist Usually they come up from off the island mainly to agitate it, attacking the NGOs and pushing the refugees back toward Moria. The police block the road off because the camp is not in the town. So the police block the road off where my understanding of it was right before you would take that left to go to Moria or go straight to go to the other side of the island and come into Mytilene that way. They had a roadblock there to prevent people from going into Mytilene. Then I heard yesterday that even Panayuda was blocked going north. You know, I'm not there, but that's what I'm getting from pretty good authority and even Greek news. So I feel fairly confident that's what's happening. That was, would have been fairly standard procedure when I was there.
Okay, so you've seen how it works or doesn't work, and you understand the knee-jerk reactions from political authorities when violence starts. And, of course, everyone's more agitated because of the pandemic.
Yes.
Where do you think this is going?
No place good. I think it's fairly apparent Europe does not want these folks. And I won't get into the right or wrong of that. I think it's just fairly apparent that they don't want them. They keep saying, well, we've given the money to Greece. But, you know, Greece is not equipped to handle this. The European Union knows that. There is some outrage from some citizens, but it's not enough. So they're able to get away with it. Citizenry that's going to hold their feet in the fire and say, these people don't deserve to be treated that way. We can do better than this. We don't have to give them the keys to the bank, but we certainly can receive them. You know, basically, I told you when I was there, when that camp was in the U.S. and I had dogs in it, not people, I'd have gone to jail for what we were having to do. And we were just trying to house them. It was a constant internal struggle. Are we doing more harm than good? And we felt like marginally, at least, we were doing more good by being there. And that's where we are now, is what are they going to do with them? They did send in, or are supposed to send in, a Blue Star ferry. I haven't heard if it got there or not, that they were going to rent and dock, and they could house about 1,000 people on that. But last time they really wanted to do that, the Mytilene people did not want that at all. So I don't know if that will happen. They were supposed to have transferred 400 unaccompanied minors to the mainland. But then last night, one of the Greek ministers saying it'd be at least 6 months before there'd be transfers off the island, because they asked the European Asylum Support Office, which helps the Greeks. The Greeks make the decisions on who gets asylum and who doesn't. Because all you can do now is when you come to Greece, you can apply for asylum in Greece. Know the country in Greece, according to their Dublin agreement. If the Greek government stays worthy, they'll grant an asylum. If not, they can be rejected and forcibly repatriated to Turkey or the last country that they came from. The Greek government is the ones who have the final say. That the ASL offices were destroyed. The Greek government offices in the camp are destroyed. They have a secondary facility on the island, but it's going to run at a very small percentage of the capacity. So it's going to just further jam up all these cases.
So you've elucidated the problem here. There's going to be very low capacity and very few means to rebuild the infrastructure necessary to process the refugees. So we're likely to have more pent-up anxiety and probably violent episodes in the future.
Oh, without a doubt.
How would you be advising and encouraging the Christians who would hear this program and care about things like dignity and human suffering? What should we do?
Whoever your representatives are in Congress, you need to be letting them know that, hey, you don't think that what's happening over there is great and that you feel as though we should share some of that burden and increase, you know, this is not going to be a super popular viewpoint, and increase the U.S. reception under the Trump administration. And I don't know if he wins or loses. I don't know that that changes under the next administration. COVID's killing our economy. It's killing our cash flow, our taxes, all that stuff. We're not in a great position like we were. And how can I say this? They need to help without the expectation of anything in return. I saw far too many people, their only purpose was to try to gain converts, and that doesn't work. You really have to be in it because your heart is easing the suffering. The rest will come because it is a long, hard, drawn out, painful process.
How should we all be praying for the situation now?
We needed to settle down in those areas over there that are still inhospitable. And we also need some Marshall plans. We had after World War II to get Europe back on its feet. We need some sort of Marshall plan to get Iraq and Syria and these other countries back on their feet. Afghanistan, I don't know how possible that is. Very distinct cultures from ours, from the West. Sometimes we have difficulty letting them make command decisions and how money will be spent, whatever the reason, valid or not. That's why I say that we have to have a total rethink of how we're handling these things.
Well, I know you're in a rock and hard place, even in your heart right now, because I know you love the people you worked with. And now you're back in the States with this boatload of memories and experience. What does God have for you now, Jeremy?
I don't know. I have a job again, doing demolition this time. My boys are 12 and 14, so I'm just trying to be dad and husband and shepherd my boys into manhood in Atlanta, which is a hard enough task on its own. Trust.
Yeah. I got you there.
Teenagers are a different creature.
Yes, they are. Well, Jeremy Holloman, previously of Euro Relief and now working Creative Destruction in Atlanta, Georgia, Thank you so much for answering God's call to go make a difference in the Moria camp. And I know you mourned along with thousands and millions of others to see something that was flawed, but was effectively serving the needs of those that came through. It's just always a tragedy to have to see such destruction happen needlessly.
Yep, I'm with you.
I would be offering the prayer that God would protect the resources that are His, that He would not let them be squandered or wasted. It provides opportunity for real healing and real futures for so many people that are hurting right now.
Amen.
Jeremy, just thank you so much for pouring in a little bit of your experience and your connections and the backstory of what's happening in Moria Camp right now on the island of Lesbos. Thanks again, my friend, for being part of Compassion Radio today.
Thanks, sir. You have a good one now.
Remember, friends, your giving this month doesn't just support this unique media ministry. Every dime beyond our baseline budgeting is going to support the relief and rebuilding efforts in Beirut, Lebanon, led by wonderful Christian ministries already on the ground and doing tremendous work. I strongly encourage you to give above and beyond this month so we can make the most impact possible. Your gift of time each day is a genuine treasure to us. Knowing that you're being challenged to live out your faith like never before is a wonderful encouragement to us as well. You can reach me directly at the following address, bramfloria@compassionradio.com. However you reach out, know that we're in this ministry and this work for you and because of you. Just call or write us today to help keep us on the air and in the field. Call 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. And jump in anytime at CompassionRadio.com. We're waiting for you, friends. Hop on board.